Yeah. Yeah, old school. That's what I'm talking about. Listen, this ain't for everybody. Some of y'all need to hear that. I know you in the trenches fighting, but check it out. I'm gonna put it down like this so I can help the saints understand. Everything you're going through is all part of the master plan. Or what? You thought because you got saved everything was gonna be peaches and cream? You better wake up, son. Don't nothing come to a sleeper but a dream. Faith without works is dead. Read your Bible. You know what it says. He who don't work don't eat. Blackers don't get fed. Yeah. Jesus said he who puts his hands to the plow looks back the same ain't fit. Some of y'all ain't been in the trenches 5 minutes and you about ready to quit. I ain't mad at ya. I'm just hitting you with the real. If you died for me, I was still tripping. Now how you think that make you feel? Check this out. Deep game. This here's deep. Some of y'all ain't sawing nothing but you're studying trying to reach. But after him who's able to possess your fathers by his glory. Struggles might be part of your testimony, but it ain't the end of the story. Now appointed since was prophesied way back in the day. Choir, sing your hook right here and see if the church can relate.
I know we can make it.
The fiery trials are to try you. You say, why you? But your shirt say, what would Jesus do? Why you asking if he ain't trying to do what he's saying? Huh? He told you he was going to have tribulations, but you thought he was playing. Huh? One minute you tell him how good God is and can't nobody beat your talk. The next minute you're backsliding so fast, it's like you're moonwalking. Huh? Oh yeah, I'm preaching to myself because I ain't no better. It ain't like I've been following his every word, obeying it to the letter. But we soldiers, we got to remember that. Regroup, stay on point. Hey, yeah, bow down, confess, repent, stay humble, let him anoint. Huh? It ain't easy as I thought it was. I'd be lying if I told you that. But it showed up getting better all the time. Trust me, that's the fact. Ain't nothing we going through that can't be handled. God put that on his son. Like they say, you can shout now if you want to, cause the battle's already won. So while you're going through the valley, don't even trip. You're gonna be on top. Choir, sing the hook line no more again. This time you don't stop.
I know we can make it.
We can make it.
I know good wealth. I can work it out. I guess you can.
Yeah, everyone, welcome to the show. It's your host, Lamont Patterson. This is Can a Player Play? I just thought I'd give a minute to Big Boy upstairs. You know, it's my hope and my wish that your belief that with his help, boy, we're going to be able to make it, boy, this thing that we call life, because it's a whole bunch of crazy-ish going on out there right about now. So I know we're going to make it. And anyway, I'd like to say welcome to the show again. We have a great dynamite show lined up for you. As usual, we try to bring guests to the show that can enlighten you, help you some type of positive way. So moving forward with this, again, thing that we call life, because a lot of things could be changed and made better. Our guest today, Mr. Tom Bowman, is an advisor, speaker, change maker that believes, you know, solutions are within our grasp. And we're going to be speaking on what is solving the climate crisis. It's simple. So, yes, we're definitely going to delve into that one, boy, because we got fires, we got droughts, we got all kind of stuff going on right now, and we need a solution. With that being said, let me see if I guess with us. Mr. Bowman, are you with us?
It's my pleasure to be here. Thank you, Lamont.
Thank you so much for taking time out to come and chat with us. You know, you have a very powerful message, and like I was saying, boy, we dealing with these things every day, and it's amazing how we take so many things for granted. But thank you for joining us.
You bet, my pleasure.
So Tom, let me see if I can call you Tom.
Of course,
a book out. What is solving the climate crisis is simple. So that is a great place to start. But first, man, we got a list of questions here for you, man. I think I need to go ahead and run through them. You know what I mean?
There you go.
I don't want to start out asking you how many dogs you got. You know? So, you know, this climate issue, and I know we see what's going on with the world today, you know, and I always talk to my friends about, you know, when I was a tad bit younger, how we knew the seasons without having to, you know, rely on a calendar. We just knew.
Yeah.
We could tell by the weather. So let me see. The first one we got for you is, why is climate change referred to as a wicked problem, and why is climate change one of them?
Yeah, that is a great question. A wicked problem is a term that's been given to any kind of problem that is so complicated we can't figure out how to solve it. And the idea of a wicked problem is that it's so complex that you can't see the whole thing, you can't get all the information you want to have to make a decision, and even if you try to solve the part you can see, you're probably going to create other problems that you can't see. And so it's sort of a defeatist mentality that says the best we can do with a wicked problem is we can do our best to manage it, but we can't really solve it, and we have to understand that as much as we try, we're still going to take some lumps along the way. And a lot of scientists refer to climate change in this exactly this way. And if you like, I can get into it. There's a reason why they describe it that way, and I think that that's a big mistake.
That's interesting. Go for it.
All right. So the reason that it's so easy to think of climate change as something that we can't solve is because we've learned about it from people who study the complexities of global systems. You know, scientists are looking at atmospheric chemistry and physics, the way heat moves around our planet, the way ocean currents interact with that, the way the biosphere, all life on the planet interacts with that, the way the polar ice sheets interact with that, and it is a really complex. I mean, the ideas are pretty simple, but all the interactions are really complicated. And so we've learned to think of it in complex terms. And unfortunately, the way that experts, so-called experts, have talked to us about how to solve the climate crisis has followed that same model. So it sounds like the climate solutions are this incredible, complicated, entangled Gordian knot of energy systems, food production systems, global delivery and transportation systems, international finance systems, international aid systems, international and local and national level governance systems, urban planning and architecture systems, utility systems. All of this stuff is, when you think of it as systems, are interacting with each other. So let's say you and I decide we're going to try to solve carbon emissions coming from food production, from agriculture. And we start pulling on that thread in this knot. Pretty soon we have to figure out how our fertilizers and herbicides, which are made from fossil fuels, get generated, and how we're going to transport our crops, where we're going to get water from, how we're going to fund our business. So we're dealing with national governance, we're dealing with international markets. And it all becomes so complex that it feels like we're too small to solve it. And it also creates this false impression that the solutions need to be managed by some sort of cadre of technical elite people who can see the whole problem, map out some kind of master plan, and then somehow govern this master plan across the entire world. We all know that nothing works that way, right? Yeah, go ahead.
No, I was just going to ask you, are these the same people? Hopefully these won't be the same people that's been following the past model.
Well, I'm really describing kind of an idea that has propagated in a lot of our thinking. And some of it's, we're aware of it, some of it's kind of unconscious. And the reason I wrote this book is that I have done so much work with scientists over the years that I've watched this way of thinking play out. And the logical conclusion of every lecture, every documentary, every book I've read is, man, we're in a world of trouble. And we know it's a wicked problem, so we can't really solve it, but we need to try our best. And so we need to somehow muster the political will to do the hard work, even though we know we're going to get hit along the way with some pretty terrible consequences. And that just strikes me as a bad place to start. And so I wrote the book remembering what an art teacher told me one time. And this is a true story. I was working on a painting when I was a young guy, and I couldn't solve it. I mean, everything I did seemed to just keep it, kind of ugly and make it worse. And he came up behind me and he said, I tell you what to do. Hang it on the wall upside down and go home. Because when you come back tomorrow, you're going to see it differently than you've ever seen it before. And you're going to know exactly what's wrong with it. And I did it. And he was exactly right. And that's a metaphor for the way to look at problems that seem intractable, right? If you think a problem can't be solved, it might just be that every solution we try has an assumption in common because we're so used to seeing the problem in the same way. And so hanging the picture upside down is a metaphor for let's go hunting for our assumptions as we try to solve this and see if they're really true. Let's set them aside for a minute and see what happens, see what reveals itself. And when you do that with the climate crisis, as complex as it looks, you discover that it really just boils down to doing one thing, and that is to stop burning fossil fuels. We know we want to do it as quickly as we can because the consequences are so bad if we don't. And we know we don't want to fail because the consequences are so bad if we don't. And so there's sort of a new mantra in this little book I wrote, and the mantra is, stop burning fossil fuels well before mid-century and absolutely, positively, do not fail. Now, that might not be easy to think about on a global scale, but it's very easy to start thinking about at the scale of our own community, of our own businesses where we work, of our own households where we live, and all of a sudden this becomes something we can all start to work on. And it means we're no longer dependent on this idea that somebody is going to figure out a master plan and somehow figure out a way to marshal all the people of the world to do the same thing. It doesn't have to work that way. Nothing works that way. We can actually do this locally everywhere. We can all be empowered and engaged, and we can make progress faster than we ever thought possible.
So what do you think the issue is that getting humanity to all get on the same page, because it seemed like for some reason people are kind of stuck?
Very much stuck. And I think I want to ask another question. What if we don't have to be on the same page? What if that's another distraction that's keeping us from getting off the sidelines ourselves and becoming active? I know a lot of social scientists who will say that the research shows that the most useful thing we can do to combat the climate crisis is try to get the people who are most concerned about it activated. These are the people who are most amenable to doing something right now. And the more we engage with people who want to do something, instead of pouring all our effort into trying to convince the deniers to come along with us, the more we'll start actually changing things in the world for the better. And as people start to see the world changing for the better, it starts to create this sense of social momentum, of mutual expectations, and we can all start generating more momentum towards positive change. It doesn't have to be smooth. It doesn't have to be consistent everywhere. But the more we generate, it's like a snowball rolling down the hill is what we're trying to start. And so more people who are more deeply on the sidelines than, say, I am, will start to join in the process, and that will influence the people in their networks, who they know, and that will begin spread. And we can hopefully change our culture and generate the kind of political momentum that will cause policymakers to join us in this work.
Yeah, I was just going to ask you that, too. How much do you think that, how much influence do you think the policymakers would have with this? Because it seemed like a lot of them are stuck also.
Oh, they are. You know, I talked to a congressman who represented me at one time. We were at a town hall that he was hosting. And somebody in the audience spoke up about an issue that mattered to a lot of people and said, why isn't Congress going to do this? Because we know we all want it. And he said, look, he just sort of told the truth for a moment. He said, you know, you have to understand. Yeah.
He said for a moment.
Well, but this is the thing. Yes, I know, exactly. But this is the thing that we all suspect, we've all been told, and here he was saying it out loud. He said that every member of Congress is there to represent the people who paid to put them there. He didn't say they're there to represent you and me. He said they're there to represent the people who wrote the big checks. And so anything we want to push through the Congress, we have to figure out how to push it through when everybody there is representing the money that put them there. Now, where's the big money? It's in big corporations. It's in entrepreneurs who have enjoyed a fairly laissez-faire kind of regulatory environment and made money. And it's the people who are invested in industries like fossil fuels that don't want to give up the advantages that they have, right? And so that's the political landscape we have to work in. And I am as hopeful as anybody else that Congress will really pass the kind of infrastructure bills and climate bills that the Biden administration is talking about. But whether they're successful or not, we can't wait for some other administration and Congress to replace them. We need to be moving now. And it leads me to wonder, is the federal government going to be the last one to the party, right? Are state governments and local governments and businesses and ordinary people going to be pushing so much change that we can generate a momentum that causes the federal government to join us? And of course, it's not just binary. It's not that they'll do nothing until we do a lot. They have done things. The Clean Power Plan, the regulations on pollution from coal-fired power plants, the protecting of Arctic wildlands from oil exploration. There's a lot going on that's in government and outside of government. It's just that we need so much more of it.
I guess what I'm saying, the Temptations had this song out once upon a time called Ball of Confusion, and that's what I'm seeing right now in the world is this big ball of confusion, and nobody really knows what to believe and who to believe and when to believe. So, you know, it's hard to facilitate any kind of change without, somebody moving in the same direction at the same time. And that's what I see that's not happening right now. So what do you see, Tom, that can help remedy that problem to even affect a climate change? Because, with everything that's going on now, the pandemic, everything in the whole political world is so confusing. You know, I mean, it's kind of hard to focus on this, but even though we see it every day with the drought, with the fires, that's affecting the whole food chain, we see it. We're living with it daily, but everybody's so inundated with all this other madness that's going on and really got all the confusion. So what's going to stop people or that slap upside the head to make everybody just stop right now to listen, listen so they can at least get the memo? That's where I'm at, because I'm seeing all the problems and everybody else see the problems, but they're so busy on this survival mode and confused. So, I don't know.
Yeah, that is a really, really good question, and it's not simple. There is a real this is just the facts. There is a psychological I want to say a trend, but it's not just that. We humans are programmed to prioritize the challenges that are immediate over the challenges that seem like we can deal with them later, right? And so long-term challenge, this is part of the reason that scientists like to call climate change a wicked problem. It evolves slowly over time. And so there's always something that feels more urgent, right? The pandemic is more urgent. The state of the economy, the state of whether I have a job or not, how am I going to put food on the table? All those kinds of things, I'm going to be able to keep my family healthy. These questions feel far more urgent and salient and tangible than whether the climate is changing. One of the ways I think we can get the slap on the side of the head that you're talking about to be effective is that in these moments when we see floods in Europe and horrific fires in the West, heat stress in the southern part of the United States, and millions of refugees, climate refugees, migrating north to our southern border from places that are becoming unlivable, is to shift a narrative You know, we always hear in the news about these problems. We never hear about solutions to these problems or progress on these problems.
Exactly.
And I would just like to tell your listeners that there is a counter narrative that's not getting much attention that says that Europe is banning the sale of internal combustion engine cars and trucks by 2030. That Ford, the biggest, you know, has announced an all-electric F-150, which is the biggest selling vehicle in the United States by a mile. The state of California has made enormous progress across the entire economy on reducing carbon emissions because of its forward-looking climate laws. The state of Iowa gets 40% or so of its electricity from wind power. There's a community that was wiped out by a tornado in Kansas called Greensburg that rebuilt as a green city. They get 100% of their electricity from wind power. So there is progress happening everywhere. It's just that we don't tend to pool it all together and say, is this a sign? Are these things together, collectively, a sign of our capacity to move in the right direction? I think they are. It's just that the news media has never told the story in that way. And so most people, most of us, hear a little anecdote about success here or a little thing about something there, and we think it's just a fragmentary thing, and we're waiting for somebody to tell us there's a master plan. But I'm here to tell you that if you just start listen to those stories with a different filter that says, hey, I heard about something else yesterday, and I hear about this today, and I heard about something else last week. There seems to be a lot going on, right? And it's that beehive of activity that in our society that is, I think, our biggest hope for changing the world more quickly than we expect we can. That's my optimistic voice.
Well, listen, we know a lot of people are walking around here with their eyes wide open. They wide open, but they're still shut. So we're going to help those out. But Tom, in your book, you described having a moment of climate epiphany. What happened? Mm. How did that change it?
Boy, yeah, this is something I don't really wish on anybody, but it sure happened to me. I used to own an exhibit design company. So I had about a dozen employees, and we designed exhibits for museums and public aquariums and trade shows for corporate clients. And in the course of doing that, I was hired by the National Academy of Sciences in Washington, D.C. to create a new museum for them, a small new museum. And anybody who would say no to the opportunity to design a museum in the nation's capital would, in my profession, would be nuts, you know. So, of course, I jumped at the chance. And the National Academy is a nonprofit chartered by Abraham Lincoln to advise the government on matters of science and medicine and engineering. So all those NRC reports, National Security, NRC, National Research Council reports, that's an arm of the National Academies, right? So it's the elite scientists come together and they're inducted based on the quality of their work. So that was my client. And the first exhibit we did was about climate science back in 2003. And so it was like going to graduate school as an independent study with climate scientists, because I had to learn the story in order to translate it into exhibits that speak to the rest of us who aren't scientists, right? And I remember being really worried by what I saw back then. And the attitude among the scientists in 2003 was, you know, yeah, this is potentially really bad. Thank goodness we have time to sort this out, because people are not unwise enough that we're going to do something really, really dangerous. So I kind of went back to work like anybody else would on other projects. And in 3 years later, I was hired by the Scripps Institution of Oceanography in Southern California, which is another highly regarded scientific research institution, and they have a public aquarium. So they wanted to do an exhibit that would open in 2007 about climate science. And the attitude among the scientists in just 3 years had just flipped 180 degrees. They were, you know, the emissions in China and Asia in general had just skyrocketed beyond anybody's expectations. The Arctic was starting to melt the ice much faster than anybody had expected. And so I was sitting, picture this, I'm sitting in this conference room at the aquarium that's got floor-to-ceiling windows. It's on the second floor on a bluff overlooking the Pacific Ocean in this beautiful cove in southern, sunny Southern California, right? It's an idyllic setting. And so we're sitting there talking about what we're going to put in the exhibit, the science officer and I. And I just casually mentioned to her, you know, the people at the National Academies had said, keep an eye on the ocean. The ocean covers, you know, almost 80% of our planet, can absorb so much heat before the water actually starts to warm that when you start to see rises in ocean temperature, it means that we're going to be committed to a changing climate for 500 or 1,000 years. And she said, oh, well, we're part of this project. It's called Argo, and we have robotic floats in every ocean in the world, and we've already measured warming in every ocean in the world to a depth of 1,000 meters. That's 3,000 feet deep, covering more than three-quarters of our planet, right? And that's the moment of epiphany. The dictionary says an epiphany is a sudden intuitive insight into some aspect of reality. Well, the thing about a real epiphany is that it changes your life because it hits you like a ton of bricks all at once. And in that moment, everything I knew about the potential risks and horrors of a destabilized climate came home to me all at once. And I realized that we're way farther into this than I had imagined. And, I mean, literally, the hair on the back of my neck stood up. I actually looked over my shoulder. It's like, is there a predator behind me? You know, it had that kind of emotional feel to it, right? And wow. And I was kind of, I was kind of trying to catch my breath. My sense of, hey, I'm a cool business owner with my client, everything's cool, was just stripped away. And she said in that moment, by the way, my boss, the director of the aquarium, would like to meet you now for the first time. So I walked into her office and I sat down. She's a scientist. And she chatted for a minute, and then she looked at me because I was literally shaking. And she said, is there anything you want to ask me? And I said, yeah. How do you cope with knowing what you know? And she went, oh, we can have a real conversation about this now, you know. And I drove home that night thinking, can I stuff this genie back in this bottle and go back to the life I used to lead? And, I mean, just 2 hours ago I was leading, and the answer, of course, to that question is not a chance. And so it fundamentally caused me to refocus my career. I started working with scientists and social scientists a lot more. I eventually I decarbonized my exhibit design company. We got recognition for that. I sold it to my employees, and because they're just, you need to be doing work on climate change beyond exhibits, I felt. And so I opened a consultancy just be able to be in the conversations that could lead to what I thought would be productive work. And I say I don't wish this on anybody, because that moment of it, I mean, I rode in an emotional roller coaster for a couple of years after that, you know. And one scientist said to me, I feel optimistic on, you know, Monday, Wednesday, Friday. I feel pessimistic Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday, and Sunday is up for grabs. And I can tell you, I don't go through that anymore, but whoa, what a ride. So my hope is that we can, in fact, be joyous and enthusiastic about creating the world we want to live in, rather than live a life of dread trying to avoid catastrophes that we don't want to see.
Wow, and that's the scary part, is being on that balance being right there to balance it. And I was thinking too while I was listening to you, Tom. I'm a fisherman, and I'm looking at how the ocean has changed, or should I say, even the quality of fish in the last 5 years. You know, I notice how it dropped off, you know, and I'm trying to figure out. Well, matter of fact, let me ask you, since this is more or less your field, do you feel like the climate changes has an effect on the ocean life?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. One of the sort of poster children of that is penguins in South America that live off of krill, tiny shrimp. And the changes in ocean temperature are moving the krill elsewhere from where the penguins are. And so, I mean, there was a time in South America where there were, you know, hundreds, thousands of penguins on the beach starving because their food supply was gone. There's this kind of disruption is happening everywhere in the climate because of the changing climate. As animals that can move and plants that can migrate easily go as far as they can, but that disrupts all the ecosystems and for everybody else. So, yes, that's happening in the ocean. The oceans are also being overfished. The amount of plastic pollution and agricultural runoff that's running into the oceans is just staggering, and that has an impact on local populations of fish, too. So it's a bunch of hits at once, I suspect, that you're seeing.
So what do you think we can do about this?
Yeah, that's been the $64 question, and I will tell you the advice from social scientists has been really interesting for a long time. They have said the most important thing each of us can do about climate change is to talk about it more with our families, friends, coworkers, employers, politicians, everybody. The lack of climate talk is one of the reasons that policymakers don't and the media don't feel like this needs to be our top priority issue. And this is a really, you know, this is taking a human psychology approach to the problem, right? That we can list all the actions we can take, and I can give your listeners some pointers if you'd like. But the most important thing we can do is break the ice, because when we do, we discover that we're not alone in our worry. Everybody is worried. The research on public opinion shows that vast majorities of people of all political stripes are concerned about the changing climate and want something done. But if we're all quiet about it, if we don't talk about it, and the research shows that not very many of us are talking about it very much, if we don't break that ice and make it normal to voice our concerns and our enthusiasm for the world we can create without smog and other kinds of pollution, and without the kind of strife that comes with climate change, we're kind of keeping a lid on it, on our capacity to act and our willpower to act. So from a very fundamental how do societies change point of view, talking about climate and talking about it as an opportunity to create a better world are the most important things we can do. And then each of us can do the things to decarbonize our business and our household and to make us more resilient to you know, more extreme weather, depending on where we live. And we can get into those things if you like, but I think that talking fundamentally is the big deal.
Okay.
And that's not what anybody's going to tell you, right? Because everybody's going to tell you we need a carbon tax, or we need an infrastructure bill, or we need to invest in this or that. That's all really good stuff to do. We should do it. And talking about it more is one of the ways we start sort of rallying ourselves to demand that of our elected leaders.
Yeah, I guess that's a good start. But then there's people out there that are the mindset that, you know, well, we've been talking about it, so now what? And then we get into what you spoke about a little while ago, you know, the electric cars and a lot of stuff going electric. Matter of fact, I built a house that's all electric, and at first I wasn't sure if I was doing the right thing, but I'm kind of okay with it now, seeing how things are going.
Yeah.
So what do you think? You know, in the next 5-10 years, you're going to see more electric homes. Well, of course, we see the electric cars coming now, but what other changes do you see?
Yeah, all electric homes is a big deal. Energy efficiency in everything that uses energy is a huge deal. It's the cheapest form of new energy in the world. It's the energy we stop using because we're more efficient, right? And for anybody buying anything that uses energy, a refrigerator, a computer, a television, any of it, if you look for the Energy Star symbol when you're shopping, that's a good place to start, because Energy Star is a program that identifies the top percentage of energy efficiency in any category. And as more and more products meet that standard, they raise the standard. And so there are fewer Energy Star rated products. And as more and more products meet that standard, they raise the standard again. And that's a way of encouraging improvements over time, right? So your 10-year-old refrigerator, Energy Star refrigerator, is far more energy intensive than a new Energy Star refrigerator. And so utility companies want you to change them, want you to replace them. And obviously, everybody's financial circumstances are different. So if you can build an all-electric home or convert your home to all-electric Energy Star systems, you're way ahead. If you can't afford to, the same rules apply. You want to use more natural light, more natural air, fans for air conditioning instead of air conditioning, if you can do it. LED lighting, you know, the simple kinds of things. If you live in a hot place, try to have more shade right around your home, because it'll keep the air cooler that's coming into your home. If you live in a cold place, you want good insulation to keep it warm. These are real basic ideas, right? And
right.
Finding ways to just implement those ideas in all the things we do is a good way for each of us to reduce our energy demand and therefore reduce our carbon footprint, while we press for the market to change and for politicians to wake up and pass legislation that will really help us make bigger progress.
Well, I guess I should say I'm happy to be alive to see some of these changes unfold. But let me say right here, Tom, for our listeners who just joined us, if you'd like to join the conversation, you could dial 646-929-2870 and press #1 on your phone, and we'd be glad to let you join the conversation. If you'd like to ask the guests a question or two about moving forward and how you could help this climate thing. Tom, in your book, What if Solving the Climate Crisis is Simple, you wrote a chapter in there, and I'm very interested in hearing you speak on this, about how what is it? You wrote an entire chapter about climate justice and confronting injustice as a white man. Why did you write about system racism in a book about solving the climate crisis?
Thank you for asking that question, because most interviewers don't ask that question.
I ain't,
you know,
scared.
I'm glad you're not.
I'm not scared. Because I want to be, look, inquiring minds wants to know.
That's right. I live in Long Beach, California, which has the busiest seaport in the United States, the ports of Long Beach and Los Angeles. There's a freeway that comes out of that port that has something like 7,000 semis on it every single day, hauling containers away from the port. And then equivalent number of trucks are coming back every day into the port to deliver empty shipping containers to send back to China to load up with more stuff to bring to big box stores and bring it back here. 7,000 trucks a day produce all kinds of diesel pollution. Guess who lives close to the freeway? It's not wealthy white people. It's people of color and people with low incomes. And that's true everywhere, right? And it means that that those who have darker skin and those who have lower incomes are suffering higher rates of asthma, childhood disease, respiratory disease, more loss of work because you're out sick, more days at the emergency room, more loss of income, and altogether poorer health than people who look like I do, because I'm a white guy. So forever, I have been hearing in the scientific press, in papers, that climate impacts people disproportionately, and that the people who will suffer from climate change the most are people of color and people with low incomes here in the United States and all around the world, right? I began working on a project last year, a collaborative project to try to build a strategy, an integrated strategy for the, hopefully, what we hope would be a Biden administration, to start developing a plan to engage, get the public empowered and involved in this. And it was a multi-ethnic, multi-racial, multi-profession set of dialogues that made absolutely, I mean, it's like another kind of epiphany, right? The idea that there's disproportional impacts is well understood. But until you really confront it, until you're really in dialogue with people who live with it, it's not as powerful. And I grew up in horrendous smog in Southern California. I know what that's like. And I lived in a mixed-race, low-income part of Los Angeles for a few years that was hot in the summer and intensely smoggy, and nobody had any money for air conditioning. And it was a really difficult place to be. And I realized that most of the people who lived there didn't have opportunities to earn more money and get out of there if they wanted to. This is just ridiculous. This is offensive. And, I mean, it's offensive right now, not 20, 50 years from now as the climate changes. It's just not right now. And so I wrote the chapter to kind of explore a little bit about how we get acculturated into systems that we all know are racist and wrong and unfair. And we find ourselves in those systems. How did I get here as a white person? You know, a lot of white people don't want to confront this because it's uncomfortable. They don't, you know, they say their hearts are in the right place. Most of us believe our hearts are in the right place, or a lot of us do anyway. And yet, here we are in a system that's still giving me an advantage that somebody else doesn't have. What's up with that? And so I heard calls during the Black Lives Matter protests last summer after the murder of George Floyd that white people need to start having their own conversation about race. And so I wrote this chapter thinking, you know, that's really true. And the only way to start it is to be as awkward as I am and just start it. And so the chapter looks at, it kind of reflects on my own experience of going into business, trying to make a living, finding that you know, my mentors in school and my mentors in business and my clients in business all have expectations that I'm trying to meet in order to advance. And all of those structures are fundamentally unjust. You know, they favor certain people over other people for no legitimate reason, right? The people of color and the low-income people who participated in these climate action dialogues were just as knowledgeable and wise and had as much experience as the people who'd been educated at Ivy League schools and had the best degrees and credentials and were white. It didn't matter. Everybody,
you know what,
go
up
ahead,
with Tom.
Please jump in. Yeah.
He who created the game also created the rules.
Yes. So true.
And unfortunately, we're dealing with the same today with just about everything. I just want to say right here, too, I definitely applaud you for that chapter in the book and recognizing that. And people never really think about it in the terms that you just mentioned, that, you know, lower-income families are destined to live in certain areas because of the economic situation. You know, people
That's
talk
right.
about it, but they really, 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 really don't take a hard look at what that really means, because guess what? They don't live in that part of Long Beach or that part of Torrance where, you know, the oil refinery, I mean, the gas and oil refineries are always catching on fire and the fallout.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people never really think about that because they're so quick and easy to say, well, I don't live there, and it really doesn't, you know, I feel sorry for them. But what does that actually mean at the end of the day to the individual
that's right.
dealing with that on a daily basis?
That's exactly right. And I, you know, my own life experience is kind of a microcosm of the problem because when I lived in South Central Los Angeles, I didn't have any money either. You know, I would spend the weekend junkyard parts for my car to keep it running so I could try to get to work during the week, you know. And do I pay the rent or do I fix my car this month? Do I buy this food or do I buy the new pair of shoes I need? I know what that's like, and I know the stress that comes with it. And I remember seeing an interview with a woman who was very low income, and she was talking about the fact that a lot of people beat up on poor people for spending their money on things like cigarettes. And she said, man, smoking is the thing that helps me get through two jobs a day when I'm exhausted and stressed. And I know the reality of that. I know the reality she's talking about because I've lived in the midst of it and I've actually experienced it myself. And yet, I was able to work my way out of there. And I have never felt comfortable with the fact that I was able to work my way out of there. And I know damn well that a lot of people there can't. Not because they don't want to, not because they don't have drive, not because they don't work hard, but because they're just in they can't get the education that would help, or their skin color and accent and ethnic background or national, you know, they're immigrants, whatever it is, puts barriers up to them that I didn't have to contend with, and that's just horrible. That's just wrong.
Yes. Trust me, I definitely understand because I can relate as a black man. I can definitely relate to everything that you're saying because I come from a little town in Texas was totally racist. So, you know, I live with some of that stuff in my life. And when I came to California, you mentioned South Central, but I went to a Catholic school on 41st in Central. I think I was the only black guy there. I was the only black guy in the whole school, so I definitely know about that. And one thing I can say about our former president, he shone a light on a lot of these racial issues that people knew existed, but they tried to play like they didn't. You try to play like they're not there, but he pulled the cover off a lot of that stuff. So I'm glad that a lot of these things are being addressed today because they're good and bad people of all races, all cultures, all nationalities, all over the world. And if for anybody that's ever traveled anywhere, I'm sure that you've recognized there's good and bad people all over the world. It doesn't
of
matter
course.
Where you come from.
And you also discover... Yeah, you also discover that we live in a country that is wealthier than any in the history of the world, and that's not the case in most of the places you travel to, right? In much of the world that you can travel to, this is another side of the both practical and moral climate challenge is that everybody who lives in countries that have been impoverished want to have a comfortable lifestyle like we enjoy here. And we are the majority of the world's emissions, those of us who live in the industrialized world, the carbon emissions. And people in low-income countries are disproportionately living with the consequences. We need to get our act together here fast and, not just to save ourselves, but also because, come on, folks. This world wasn't put here just for me to have a happy life and then leave nothing behind. I mean, that makes no sense to me.
No. It's a ball of confusion.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk a little bit about your action for climate empowerment.
Mm-hmm.
What is that project about?
So, you know, part of the Paris Climate Agreement that Trump pulled us out of and Biden put us back into has an article in it, Article 12, that reaffirms that from the underlying treaty that every nation of the world needs to empower its citizens, to its residents, to participate in finding and implementing solutions to the climate crisis. You know, if you accept Biden's language that climate is the existential threat of our time, the idea that we can continue to live the way we live without changing anything in the face of an existential threat just doesn't make any sense, right? If it's an existential threat, we need all of the expertise, all of the creativity, all of the initiative of an informed and empowered public to create and implement solutions. And they'll be different. In Texas, solutions will be different than in Southern California or than in Nebraska or in New England or in the Caribbean. There'll be solutions that fit, that work where each of us, where our communities are. So the Paris process urges every country to create a national strategy to do this, to create policies for education and workforce development and in professional training, employee training, for public access to information, public participation in policymaking and organizational decision making and all the rest of it, and collaboration, cooperation with a justice and gender equity and intergenerational, you know, lens that says our kids and grandkids have the same rights to a healthy world that we were born with, to create a national strategy to empower all of this across their societies. And as it happens, some nations have done it, but none of the major emitting countries of Europe, Japan, the United States, China, India have done it. And so a group of over many years, a group of people who are concerned about this mostly from education work, but from advocacy work, from communication work like I do, have been talking about how do we create a national strategy for a country as diverse as the United States is. And recognizing that an election was coming up in 2020, early in that year, this group of people got together and said, let's figure out if we can create the framework for a national strategy for the United States. We don't have the standing. We're not the White House. We can't officially do a national strategy for the United States, but we can do a pilot project that is a blueprint and that maps out the big themes for a national strategy for public engagement if we do it by recruiting a diverse group of professionals from different geographies, different ethnic backgrounds, different professional backgrounds, and we bring them together in dialogues and do the kind of exercises together, forecasting exercises together and strategic planning that will give us a framework that we can give to the new administration and say, here's the blueprint for creating a national strategy. This should influence every policy in the federal government, and you should encourage it across subnational governments, meaning states, counties, municipalities, tribal governments, and organizations. And so we hosted a group of online dialogues. We were doing this during the pandemic, so we met over Zoom, and it was these dialogues were so incredibly inspiring and transformational because you realize the depth of capacity that exists in this country, but it's distributed everywhere. And so I was invited into this process as a participant and also to be one of the writers of the framework. So my writing partner, Deb Morrison, and I wrote this strategic planning framework for the United States, and it went through three rounds of reviews. First of all, the coordinating team reviewed it, and we edited it, and then we brought in a group of 20 very diverse strategic reviewers who have different expertise and backgrounds. They reviewed the document, and our mission was to give voice to the people who created the insights, the knowledge that was pooled here. So we did another round of review, and then it went out to the community itself, the networks of people who had participated and their broader networks, and we got literally a couple thousand comments or so. We responded to every single one, did a final edit, and we released this on November 30th of last year. And it has gotten some exposure within the Biden-Harris administration. It's gotten some exposure with some members of Congress, with some folks in the news media, and we are continuing. Those who were engaged in this process felt so energized by it and by its potential that we are working hard on different avenues to push the federal government in this direction to be, and, you know, our view is that we should lead the world in creating a national strategy that works for the United States, brings together educators, communicators, local activists, large-scale activist organizations, the business community, to create essentially a national mobilization to solve the climate crisis. We argue that the all-of-government strategy that the Biden-Harris administration is pursuing really needs to be met by an all-of-society mobilization to support it, to engage in it, to do it. And so that's the nature of this work, I think.
Yeah, that kind of led into my next question. Do you feel like the Biden administration is on the right track? That's part one of the question. The second part of that same question is, do you feel like the powers that be are going to let them play out?
Yeah, two really good questions. I think the Biden administration has been working really hard to get its feet under it in this space. I think the appointment of Gina McCarthy to be the domestic climate czar and John Kerry to be the international climate leader for the United States, envoy, it's a big, big first step. And the president signed an executive order that calls for an all-of-government strategy and tasks the various federal agencies with working on pieces of this. They also organized what's called the WEJAC, the White House Environmental Justice Advisory Council, which has an independent group that has already issued a final report to the federal government. And they have also appointed this process I described last year is known by the acronym ACE, Action for Climate Empowerment, so ACE. And they've appointed a dual ACE national focal point, which is one of the steps that the Paris Agreement calls for. And the ACE focal points, we are hoping, will get the authorities to start really working on this strategic work to empower the public, not just empower the federal government to do its work. So in a way, all eyes are on the infrastructure bill and whether it can get through Congress in a way that is really, really productive. And in another way, behind the scenes, a bunch of us are working as hard as we can to try to gain traction for a whole-of-society mobilization model that can work through the federal agencies, the extension agency, education leads, the rulemakers, those who incentivize and work with local communities, so that there is sort of a top-down meeting a bottom-up, right? That's the holy grail here. And will they succeed? Will we succeed? We don't know. Unless you're one of the people who is really in the room in those discussions in the White House and in the federal agencies, it's hard to read the tea leaves. But there are some positive signs, and there's a real sense that people who work on the climate crisis are seeing enough of a difference in the Biden administration that people have been energized by it, with some skepticism. I mean, people are going to hold the Biden administration's feet to the fire. It could very easily slide into sort of status quo with good intentions, but I don't think the people who work on climate are going to stand for that too long.
Well, Tom, listen, We're just about out of time here, man. But we're going to leave that one a question mark open for you. So I want
there
you to come back to the show, man, so we can finish that conversation. And we're going to start it out with that one right there, and we're going to be able to look at it again.
I'll look forward to that.
Oh, definitely, definitely, man. I'm going to look forward to it as well because we're both going to be walking around with our eyes wide open to see what they do.
That's right. That's right. Listen, thank you so much for having me on, Lamont. This has been terrific.
Oh, man, we enjoyed you immensely. And I just want to tell our listeners again, if you join the show late, it'll be available worldwide, so you have no excuse, no reason why you can't hear it and can't get it from anybody. And I tell you the same thing weekly. Ask your mama, ask your daddy, ask your neighbor across the street, ask the guy at the gas station or the man that worked at the supermarket. Somebody will be able to tell you where you can hear the show, so you don't have no excuse. And definitely, Mr. Tom Bowman, have a message, and each and every one of you guys can benefit, take notes, and support. We do need to make changes, and I want to thank you so, so very much for joining us today. Tom, I thank you again, and the door is open. Come back anytime. We'd love to have you.
And, thank you. It's been my honor to be here.
Continue to be safe. Everybody,
all right.
We'll see you guys next week, same time, 2:30 PST. Be safe. And take this one home with you.
God is good, 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 good.
Yeah. But had not been for the Lord on my side, brought me through. And toil, snare, trap.
That is what I tell him when they ask me how I'm living. Huh? God is good. And he's running. That's help a brother out. No doubt. I lost my breath. Mama didn't know me, devil had control of me, ha, he had control of me, and so I saw the light from above, ha, felt the love, the power of he who was there from the very beginning. They